Chapter 53. We're having an hot dinner, and entertainers. My reaction to the word surprised me. They stirred up a mixture of emotions, all of them pleasant. Fulfillment, happy acceptance, almost triumph. I know by now that there's not the slightest chance of anybody asking me to be president of the Royal College of Veterinary Surgeons. But if they had, I wonder if I'd been more pleased than when I heard about the hot dinner. The reason, I suppose, was that the words reflected the attitude of a typical Dales farmer towards myself. And this was important, because though, after just over a year, I was becoming accepted as a vet, I was always conscious of the gulf that was bound to exist between these hill folk and a city product like me. Much as I admired them, I was aware always that we were different. It was inevitable, I knew, but it still rankled, so that a sincere expression of friendship from one of them struck a deep answering chord in me. Especially when it came from somebody like Dick Rudd. I had first met Dick last winter on the doorstep of Scaledale House. At 6 o'clock on the kind of black morning when country vets wonder about their choice of profession. Shivering as the ever-present passage draught struck at my pyjamaed legs, I switched on the light and opened the door. I saw a small figure muffled up in an old army greatcoat and balaclava leaning on a bicycle. Behind him, the light spilled onto a few feet of streaming pavement where the rain beat down in savage swathes.
"Sorry to ring your bell at this hour, Governor," he said. "Me name's Rudd, Birchtree Farm, Colston. I've got a heifer calving, and she's not getting on with job. Will you come?"
I looked closer at the thin face, at the water trickling down the cheeks and dripping from the end of his nose.
"Right, I'll get dressed and come straight along. But why don't you leave your bike here and come with me in the car? Colston's about 4 miles, isn't it? You must be soaked through." "Nay, nay, it'll be all right."
The face broke into the most cheerful of grins, and under the sopping balaclava a pair of lively blue eyes glinted at me.
"I'd only have to come back and get it another time. I'll get off now, and he won't be there long before me."
He mounted the bike quickly and pedalled away. People who think farming is a pleasant, easy life should have been there to see the hunched figure disappear into the blackness and the driving rain. No car, no telephone. A night up with the heifer, 8 miles biking in the rain, and a back-breaking day ahead of him. Whenever I thought of the existence of the small farmer, it made my own occasional bursts of activity seem small stuff indeed. I produced a nice live heifer calf for Dick that first morning, and later, gratefully drinking a cup of hot tea in the farmhouse kitchen, I was surprised at the throng of young Rudds milling around me. There were 7 of them, and they were unexpectedly grown up. Their ages ranged from 20-odd down to about 10, and I hadn't thought of Dick as middle-aged. In the dim light of the doorway at Scaledale House, and later in the bar, lit only by a smoke-blackened oil lamp, his lively movements and perky manner had seemed those of a man in his 30s. But as I looked at him now, I could see that the short, wiry hair was streaked with grey, and a maze of fine wrinkles spread from around his eyes into his cheeks. In their early married life, the Rudds, anxious like all farmers for male children, had observed with increasing chagrin the arrival of 5 successive daughters.
"We nearly packed up then," Dick confided to me once.
But they didn't, and their perseverance was rewarded at last by the appearance of 2 fine boys. A farmer farms for his sons, and Dick had something to work for now. As I came to know them better, I used to observe the family with wonder. The 5 girls were all tall, big-limbed, handsome, and already the 2 chunky young boys gave promise of massive growth. I kept looking from them to their frail little parents.
"Not a picking on either of us,"
as Mrs. Rudd used to say, and wonder how the miracle had happened. It puzzled me, too, how Mrs. Rudd, armed only with the milk check from Dick's few shaggy cows, had managed to feed them all, never mind bring them to this state of physical perfection. I gained my first clue one day when I'd been seeing some calves, and I was asked to have a bit of dinner with them. Butcher's meat was a scarce commodity on the hill farms, and I was familiar with the usual expedients for filling up the eager stomachs before the main course, the doughy slabs of Yorkshire pudding or the heap of suet dumplings. But Mrs. Rudd had her own method.
A big bowl of rice pudding with lots of milk was her hors d'oeuvre. It was a new one on me, and I could see the family slowing down as they ploughed their way through. I was ravenous when I sat down, but after the rice, I viewed the rest of the meal with total detachment. Dick believed in veterinary advice for everything, so I was a frequent visitor to Birch Tree Farm. After every visit, there was an unvarying ritual. I was asked into the house for a cup of tea, and the whole family downed tools and sat down to watch me drink it. On weekdays, the eldest girl was out at work and the boys were at school, but on Sundays, the ceremony reached its full splendor with myself sipping the tea and all nine Rudds sitting around in what I can only call an admiring circle. My every remark was greeted with nods and smiles all round. There is no doubt that it was good for my ego to have an entire family literally hanging on my words, but at the same time, it made me feel curiously humble. I suppose it was because of Dick's character. Not that he was unique in any way, there were thousands of small farmers just like him. But he seemed to embody the best qualities of the Dalesman. The indestructibility, the tough philosophy, the unthinking generosity and hospitality. And there were the things that were Dick's own. The integrity, which could be read always in his steady eyes, and the humour, which was never far away. Dick was no wit, but he was always trying to say ordinary things in a funny way. If I asked him to get hold of a cow's nose for me, he would say, solemnly, "I'll endeavour to do so." Or I remember when I was trying to lift the square of plywood which was penning a calf in a corner, he said, "Just a minute till I raise portcullis." When he broke into a smile, a kind of radiance flooded his pinched features. When I held my audiences in the kitchen with all the family reflecting Dick's outlook in their eager laughter, I marvelled at their utter contentment with their lot. None of them had known ease or softness, but it didn't matter. And they looked on me as a friend, and I was proud.